Afternoon. It's been a really interesting afternoon. And what I'm going to be talking about is picking up on some of the themes of Jeremy's talk. So my title is Formal Equivalence and Theoretical Equivalence, but really what interests me is cases in which you have formal equivalence and theoretical inequivalence. But then that in itself tells us something, I think, about the conditions under which you have theoretical equivalence. Okay, so I wanted to try and situate what I'm talking about in the larger topic of the colloquium for today. So we had three different areas that we were bringing together: emergence, effectiveness, and equivalence. And I'm most directly going to be following up, as I said, on Jeremy's talk about dualities and cases of equivalence. So there's two threads that I'm going to pull out of thinking about dualities. And actually, the question period was picking up on some of these threads. So I'm interested in the use of dualities as a heuristic strategy in physics. And one of the things that's been noted, in particular by Sebastian and Jeremy, but other people as well, is that the usefulness of dualities in their heuristic application is the interesting examples mostly come from quantum physics. And maybe you could be even a little bit more specific than that and pinpoint quantum field theory and string theory and quantum gravity as being the locus for the really interesting examples of dualities. So the interesting examples are the ones that are the surprising examples, or where you feel like you're gaining some knowledge of the world by discovering that there's this, that you have dual models. So that's one feature. The other feature is that in these surprising cases, you have a situation that the dual theories or models, at least one of them has to be at the beginning, set up such that you don't have a fixed physical interpretation of it in mind, so that you can eventually figure out, using your duality, that you've discovered that you're saying the same things about the world in two apparently strikingly different ways. So Jeremy, since he just gave his talk, I can say this a little bit more specifically, and actually Sebastian's talk as well. When thinking about dualities and trying to come up with a philosophical account of how they work, that's a natural step to think about what Jeremy and Sebastian called bare theories, right? So Jeremy just described that as going up a level and thinking about the theory of theories or something like that. But an important feature of these, of the bare theories that you use in order to theorize about the dualities, is that they don't have they're not interpreted, right? The next step is to take the bare theory and to give an interpretation. So these two features together are both features that interest me in other kinds of cases. So what I want to propose is that dualities are only one of the examples that we find in quantum physics that share these two features. I'm thinking here in particular of the use of dualities as a heuristic device in physics, is to try and attempt to guess at a new theory, or to try and provide that kind of the kind of inspiration that it sometimes does. So I'm interested particularly in quantum physics and in the question of how our methods, or how our, and particular methods that we use in the course of discovering new theories, how they've changed in quantum physics when we compare it to earlier eras in physics. I'm also interested in making use of formal properties, right? So this is the second feature I have here, where you are comparing theories without looking so much at the, without paying attention to the physical interpretation. Okay, so what I have in mind when I make this proposal, there's another example of this type of thing, and it's not in the use of dualities, but it's in the use of analogies that you find between condensed matter physics and quantum field theory. So the examples I've looked at most carefully are spontaneous symmetry breaking and renormalization group methods. And if we look at the heuristic role in discovery, that the analogy is played in these two cases, then we discover that what was really important about these analogies was that they laid bare formal similarities between the mathematics in the two cases. Okay, so all right, so. The thesis I'm going to argue for, the thesis I have in mind, I'm not going to argue for at all today, is that there are cases in quantum physics in which formal analogies that are accompanied by substantial physical disanalogies have played a central role in, heuristic role in the development of new theories and models in quantum physics. So to be more specific, what I have in mind by a formal analogy is, once again, like dualities, we're considering you have two models, two physically interpreted models in this case, and you have a formal analogy when you have a mapping between the two in which the elements are mapped, and the mappings are determined on the basis of the formal roles that the elements play in the theories. So in most cases, formal means mathematical. So the simplest case is where you have a single mathematical structure, an equation, the wave equation, some of the examples that Jeremy was talking about, and you give it two different physical interpretations. Contrast this to a physical analogy in which you base your analogical mappings, or your analogical mappings are determined by similarities between the physical interpretations of the equations and not just the form of the equations. All right, so the case that I'm going to talk about is the development of renormalization group methods for application in particle physics. So I'm going to zero in on the contributions made by Kenneth Wilson and his collaborators in the early 1970s. Since I've chosen this example of renormalization group methods, emergence is going to incidentally come in, but I'm not primarily going to talk about emergence in this talk. Effectiveness also comes in eventually, but I want to flag that I'm not getting to effective field theories in this talk, because that was a slightly later historical development than what I'm going to be talking about today. All right. So also I want to underscore that I'm going back to the early 1970s and trying to understand the role of formal analogies as a tool in the discovery of renormalization group methods. So obviously we've learned a lot since then, it's important for me to look at the historical case study because I want to understand the role that analogies played as a heuristic tool, right? As a tool in discovery. Okay, so I've also talked about some similarities between heuristic uses of dualities and formal analogies, but of course we need to keep the differences in view as well. In particular, this important difference, which is a point of contrast, that is one reason why it's going to be useful to think about these two case studies alongside each other. So, in particular, in the case of dualities, it's possible that the dual theories and models are going to be describing the same physical system, and this is the case that we're particularly interested in, usually in physics, whereas in the case of formal analogies, it's the case that formally analogous theories describe different physical systems. Okay, so the example I'm going to be looking at, the analogies we're drawing are between a model of condensed matter physics and a model of particle physics. So there are different physical systems that you can make out the difference phenomenologically. So the phenomena that the models are constructed in order to describe on the condensed matter side. Again, I'm going to talk about the Ising model. I'm going to talk about ferromagnets. So we have critical phenomena, phase transitions in ferromagnets on the one hand, and then the model in particle physics. Describes the phenomena that happen at the Large Hadron Collider, for example. So you have different sets of phenomena, and so the models are constructed to describe different physical systems underlying those phenomena. Okay, so this is why I flagged at the beginning that what I'm interested in here with formal analogies is a case in which, at least in the sort of idealized, simplified cases, you're going to have a case of formal equivalence. But at the same time, it's a kind of formal equivalence where you know that you have theoretical inequivalence. So you don't ever expect to find yourself in a situation where you have a mathematical, that you're going to have a formal equivalence that's going to lead to descriptions of the same, which are physically equivalent, or descriptions of the same physical systems even. Okay. So as I said, I think one of the reasons, so this talk's sort of an advertisement for thinking about these two case studies together, because they do have some features which are similar, but this feature that makes them different, I think, is also a reason why we want to think more about the cases in which we use these two strategies, and think about cases in which we should be looking for dualities, or in which dualities are useful, and cases in which formal analogies are useful. All right, so here's an overview of what I'm gonna talk about. So as I said, I'm going to start out by talking about this case study of the development of the renormalization group methods for application in particle physics and quantum field theory that Wilson and his collaborators developed. There's two steps, so you can follow what I'm going to talk about. This is the sort of simplified version in which there's two steps. So the first step is going to be the Wick rotation step, and then the second step is going to be taking the limits. And then I'm going to come back to talking about these heuristic questions about why in this case formal analogies are useful, and make some remarks just starting to think about how to compare this to dualities. So I've talked about both of most of this material in these two papers, if you're interested in following up. All right, so to set the stage, and actually I benefit from the fact that this has been talked about a couple times already, but to set the stage, in the early 1970s, Kenneth Wilson is thinking simultaneously about the theoretical problems with representing critical phenomena, including phase transitions in the favorite ferromagnetic iron bar example that we've been talking about. In particular, a problem with representing what happens at the critical point that Sebastian was talking about earlier. At the same time, he really wants to solve the problem of how to represent strong interactions in particle physics. So putting these two ideas together, he develops renormalization group methods. So the focus here is going to be on what this means for quantum field theory, what this means for particle physics. So in order to formulate particle physics, the renormalization methods on the particle physics side, what he does is he starts out with a representation of the ferromagnet, which is a variation on the classical icing model for the ferromagnet. So we've already talked about this a little bit. I have a diagram here in a second. So that's what you have on the condensed matter side. So it's a classical model, statistical mechanical model of the ferromagnet. And then on the quantum field theory side, what you have is a quantum field theory system, which is a scalar quantum field theory system with a phi-4 self-interaction term. Okay, so here is how he sets up the correspondence between these two systems. So on the left, we have our iron bar, our representation of our iron bar in two dimensions. So the points are the ions on our lattice, and it's a lattice of spins. So we represent them using a spin field on this lattice. And so the zeros and ones represent spin up and spin down. And what we're interested in, as Sebastian explained, is in correlations between the values of the spins at different positions on this lattice. On the quantum field theory side, I've drawn something that's supposed to look like a blanket, but of course, part of the point here is that this is going to be part of the point at the end. Well, we have somewhat of an idea of how we should represent our iron bar. We have very little idea about how we should represent our quantum field. So think of this classically the way I've done the diagram, but that's not how it works in quantum real life. Okay, so what we have here is we have space and time, and we have our quantum field on a spatial lattice in order to introduce the cutoffs at the beginning, in order to tame the divergences, which we know crop up. And because we're going to be recognizing the correspondences between these two models, of course, we're going to be focusing on calculating the vacuum expectation values of fields at different space-time points. Okay, so the first step then is to equate the correlation functions, since it's classical system mechanical correlation functions, get equated with propagators, vacuum expectation values, T is time ordering, omega is the vacuum here. So what we do is, the first step is to Wick rotate. We take the time variable in our quantum field theory, and we take it to negative imaginary time, and then up to a constant, we can equate the two products, expectation values that we're interested in. Okay, so we're thinking about how the analogies work in this example. So after the first step, we get a few sort of straightforward analogical mappings. So the spin field is going to be the analog of the quantum field. Space, or two-dimensional space in the simple example, is going to be the analog of space-time, with negative imaginary time. And then the correlation functions are the analogs of the vacuum expectation values. So I want to stress the point that these analogies are formal analogies. So there's kind of two sides to what's important to me. The first part is the positive argument that these are formal analogies. So the terms are playing formally analogous roles here. And I should say that I'm taking this analysis from Wilson and Kobitz's paper on this, and so this is all material that they discuss in the paper, although I'm not giving you the quotes in this talk. But when I say that they play formally analogous roles as dependent and independent variables, and we've already talked about the expectation values of the products of the fields at space-time points are the formal quantities that we're interested in calculating. Okay, so the negative argument is the interesting one, right? So there are substantial physical disanalogies between these two the sets of quantities that we've mapped. The first one, which is going to reverberate through the whole case study, is the fact that you have the two dimensions of space in the classical statistical mechanical model are mapping to space-time in quantum field theory. So we know space is, well, in lots of respects, physical respects, not like time, so this is going to have a bunch of consequences. So one consequence is that spatial translations on our in our icing model are going to be the analogs of time translations in our quantum field theory. One thing you might even start wondering at this point is what happens to causal relations, causal processes in the classical statistical mechanical model. And does the fact that time gets mapped to space already mess things up? The short answer is yes, but you can see this much better after I take the next after the next step. Okay, so what the point of coming up this formal analogy in this way is, of course, from the perspective of quantum field theory, to obtain a continuum representation of our quantum field theory system, which initially we put on the lattice in order to kill off the divergences. Okay, so so Wilson here sees that there's a formal analogy to be made between the condensed matter physics case of critical phenomena. And this case in quantum field theory, we're going to take the continuum limit, the UV limit, the continuum limit, and remove the lattice. So, So what he sees is that the problems both involve what he calls statistical continuum limits. And he has some quite, in his very early papers, he has some really nice passages articulating this concept. And he very clearly sees that what he's done is he's introduced a more sophisticated kind of limit, which he sees as being directly analogous and a successor to the ordinary limits, as he calls them, that you find in the calculus in differential equations. Okay, so he sees that these two limits are formally analogous. So the correlation length goes to infinity, as Sebastian explained to us. The critical point occurs when the correlation length diverges, which physically means that that you have macroscopic scale phenomena, macroscopic correlations between the spins on different parts of your lattice. And in quantum field theory, what we're interested in is we want to get rid of the lattice spacing, or in the usual terms that you find in QFT, you want to take your momentum cutoff to infinity. All right, so this is what this looks like diagrammatically. And so the top pictures that I have here, if you squint at them, though actually they're a bit fuzzy anyway, so you might not even need to squint, they should look very similar. Right? So Wilson's insight was that formally, or mathematically speaking, these two representations look very similar. What I want to stress here, though, is that since we're focusing on the analogies and how the analogical mappings play out, the limits, so the arrows are the limits. So on the left-hand side, what we need to do is we need to zoom out, right? So if we have the scale where we're looking at a few ions in our lattice of our ferromagnet, when you have the correlation length going to infinity, that also means you need to zoom out a coarse grain in order to see what you want to see, which is correlations across large length scales. All the time, though, you're not doing anything to the lattice. The lattice is a fixed piece of your model that you just put in at the beginning. What happens on the quantum field theory side is we're taking this limit, and actually we should keep going because we have to take our lattice to zero, so I haven't gotten there yet. That happens somewhere up at the ceiling. So what we need to do, so what's actually happening is the spacing between the lattice is actually being taken to zero in this case. So the endpoint looks similar, right? But the lattice looks invisible if you actually go up to infinity, but it's still there physically. Whereas on this side, the lattice actually is taken to zero. It's supposed to disappear. Okay. So, all right. So, thinking about the analogical mappings that you get from from comparing the two systems in this way and recognizing that the similarity is in the statistical continuum limits that you get in both cases. The analog limits are the correlation length going to infinity and the momentum cutoff going to infinity as well. If you look at your models more carefully, and I'm not going to go through this part in any detail, but if you look at your models more carefully, Sebastian gave us a nice explanation of how it is the temperature plays an important role in the ferromagnetic case, that when you take the temperature to the critical temperature, that has the effect of increasing the correlation length until you get to the point where it's infinity and you have hit the phase transition. If you follow that analogy across to the other side, what you are doing on the quantum field theory side is as you are taking the momentum cutoff to infinity, the analog is that you are adjusting the value of the bare mass, which is the mass that's not the renormalized value. So that's what the analog is there. All right, so again, the analogies are formal analogies. The positive argument for that is, actually Wilson does a really nice job of making this the case for this. The statistical continuum limit problems are similar problems because they take a similar mathematical form. Okay. And as in the other case, here you also find that there are substantial physical disanalogies between the elements that we've mapped here on the basis of formal similarity. So there's, of course, the pragmatic differences. So the goals of taking statistical continuum limit is in the two cases. In the classical statistical mechanics case, or just generically in condensed matter models of the ferromagnet, the inspiration or motivation was to explain universal behavior. Again, Sebastian talked a little bit about that. Whereas in quantum field theory, motivation that Wilson talks about is wanting to have finite values for the vacuum expectation values or the propagators, and being able to have a model that can from which he can derive sensible finite predictions for those quantities. So this one is something that I already emphasized as I explained it. So the underlying difference here is that the continuum limit, taking the correlation length to infinity, is a physical process in the ferromagnet, whereas taking the momentum cutoff to infinity is not a physical process. So if we go back to the diagram. So here I have it in terms of the lattice, which is the equivalent, taking the lattice spacing to zero. So what I'm saying here is taking the lattice spacing to zero is something that's done within the sequence of mathematical models, but it's not a physical process that happens in the world. Whereas on this side, what we have is we have, as we take the correlation link to infinity, we have a sequence of models at different temperatures, each of which is a model of a state of a system in the physical world. Okay, and finally, this is where we get to the mismatch between the causal processes. So the formal analogies that we picked out between these two models don't respect the causal processes, the causal structure. So so we do have a nice causal story about what happens in the case of the phase transition in our ferromagnet. What happens, as Sebastian explained, recall, is that the reason why temperature has an effect on whether the magnet is spontaneously magnetized or not is that temperature tends to knock our spins out of alignment. So if the temperature is too high, then this prevents the magnet from spontaneously magnetizing, so that this then is the process that changes as you change the temperature. Whereas there's no causal relationship between the bare mass and the high momentum cutoff. They co-vary in the limit as the limit is being taken, but it's not as if changing the bare mass, whatever that means, is what changes the value of the momentum cutoff. All right. Okay, so to recap, this then is an example where, without question, obviously, renormalization group methods are now used all over the place in physics and beyond physics. So it's without question that this was a major achievement and a major contribution. So this is a success story of the use of this heuristic method of recognizing that there are these formal similarities between these two models and following up on the consequences. So then the follow-up question for us is, this is a case study of a successful use of a method to discover new physics. So why exactly were formal analogies successful in this case? And more specifically, this is a case in which we're interested because these formal analogies are accompanied by the substantial physical disanalogies that I pointed out. Okay, so the fact that there are these substantial physical disanalogies that I pointed out rules out one answer that you might want to have recourse to try and explain the success of the methods. So you might think that the reason why paying very careful attention to the icing model was helpful in particle physics is that these analogies pick out physical similarities between the icing model and the model for the 5-4 interaction that I was talking about in quantum field theory. But that can't be the answer here because, as I pointed out, there's actually not similarities but substantial differences between the two cases. Okay, so here's the applicability of mathematics answer for why these analogies were useful. So if we take a step back and think in the abstract about why renormalization group methods in general are useful, be it in the quantum field theory case study or the icing model case study or in any other case study, then this is a description which is abstract enough that it can that it captures what's the reason why renormalization group methods are applicable in all of these cases. And again, this is something that I've taken from Wilson, which he does a nice job of explaining in the course. This is not novel physics, but it is important from the point of view of thinking about the usefulness of the methods. Okay, so the first thing is thinking about why use statistical continuum limits in particular is that it's a case in which you have a function of a continuous variable, a field, you make those fields themselves independent variables. So these E's are just classical electromagnetic fields because that's what Wilson's talking about here. So when you have that kind of situation where you're thinking about these limits of fields and your fields, the values of the fields fluctuate, that means that types of what you want to compute in those cases are averages over ensembles of your fields, right? So that was the vacuum expectation values in quantum field theory or propagators. You would also have, on the statistical mechanical side, you just have correlation functions. In particular, if there's going to be no characteristic scales, which simplify your calculation for you. If you can make an assumption about the local coupling that you have between the wavelengths, by which I mean not locality in space, but between scales, there's local coupling between scales. These are the conditions which make renormalization group methods applicable. Okay, so notice a couple of things here. First of all, that these are abstract characterizations, which means that you can introduce on top of this different interpretations for the fields. Your fields could be, well, here's the electromagnetic field, but you could also have a quantum field as your field, or you'd have a spin field as your field. Scales here doesn't have to be distance scales. It could be energy scales, time scales. You have to have some scale, right? So that's an example of how this can be applied in many different to many different types of models. Okay, thinking about this aspect of this type of explanation of why it was formal analogies that were useful in this case, right? So in the development of a mathematical method, which then had applications all over the place at the end of the day. So thinking about the comparison to dualities. The contrast with dualities is that let me go back to this one here, because I didn't talk about dualities here. The interesting types of dualities are cases in which you do want to learn something about the physics, right? And the heuristic function of the dualities is supposed to identify a mapping between models, which is telling you something about the physics. In the case of the formal analogies, you're not learning anything about the physical similarities between the two systems. Okay, so I think that this is a particular. So when we're trying to describe interesting uses of dualities or interesting cases in which we have dualities, this is probably more general or in terms of the level of the mathematical framework that we're, and the formal similarities or formal mappings that we're talking about here is more general than we want to be thinking about when we're thinking about dualities. Or higher level, I guess you might say. There's something else I wanted to mention as well, which maybe relates to some of what Jeremy was arguing to do with thinking about intentions of and intentional interpretations of our models. So I think another important dimension of the answer to the question about why it is that formal analogies were useful in this case is because physicists possessed intuitions about the entities and processes described by the classical statistical mechanical model. What I mean by that is the Ising model had modeled all sorts of different physical systems, and it was much more intuitive in terms of how the model was set up than the quantum field theory models. So you could see that from my diagrams, right? That when you can, the fact that you can set up the Ising model and you can give a, and you can describe what you're supposed to be modeling is in contrast to the quantum field theory model. And so it's much easy, it's much more intuitive, the condensed matter physics model than the quantum field theory model. So I think actually this is a, if you look at other examples of times at which analogies to condensed matter physics systems have played a really important role in quantum field theory and particle physics in particular, I think this is a common theme of these types of analogies, is that the fact that you have stronger intuitions and a clearer physical picture of what's going on in condensed matter physics systems, relatively speaking, than you do in the particle physics systems, is something which makes those models easier to deal with, and also gives having these intuitions lying behind the formal mathematics is helpful. So just recognizing those formal similarities. Speculation is that that would not be as helpful if it weren't for the fact that you have a more fully fleshed out physical picture on the one side than you do on the other side. So again, coming back to dualities, I think that this is actually something that's in common with some of the examples of dualities that are interesting, where at least on one side of the duality, the interpretation of the model is not as fully fleshed out, or parts of it are indeterminate, or you have a model on one side that's only partially physically interpreted. So I think that this is a similar feature of these types of models. All right, so to conclude, this is an invitation to think about the case studies of theoretical equivalence, and in particular to think about dualities, not only comparing them to symmetries and to gauge theories and to other types of examples like that, but to comparing them to examples such as this one about formal analogies, where we know that we don't expect to ever end up in a point where we are identifying the models as being theoretically equivalent or physically equivalent in any way, but we still recognize that we have formal equivalences in the best case, or at least we have these formal similarities between the models. Thanks.
Time for a couple questions. Could you actually clarify more about your last point? I mean, somehow this, what you were saying about this connection of a normalization group between your Ising model and five-fourth theory, and sounds a lot like what Sebastian was saying about ADS-CFT, right? You know, but before we were talking about ADS-CFT as kind of a duality, and now it sounds like it's an analogy. So I've got myself confused over this. Can you enlighten me?
Okay, good. So,
I mean, that was to say that there are mathematical objects in both theories. So in the case of ADS-CFT, there are these correlation functions between the algebra and conformal. The conformal algebra is the same between both of them, so you can use the same technique to calculate this. And here you're also calculating similar entities, even though they have very different significance in the Ising model and in the
Yeah, so I think actually, and actually maybe Sebastian might want to comment on this too, but so from my point of view, the difference between the ABS-CFT case and this case of formal analogies that I'm talking about is that at the outset in my case, we expect that we're going to have physical interpretations all the way through. Different physical interpretations of our models right. all the way through. So that's partly because we've nailed down, we've at least nailed down phenomenologically the fact that our icing model refers to phase transitions in magnets, and our QFT model is referring to whatever it is that happens at the Large Hadron Collider. So we don't expect that learning about this formal equivalence is going to change our mind about that, right? So we're never going to be in a position where we're going to want to be tempted to say that we have two models that describe the same things, right? Because the systems are different that we think our models are representing. So the objects are different. What I was getting at here with this slide is thinking about why it is heuristically you would want to use formal analogies if you know that you're never going to get to a point where you have the same physics. I think it is really useful not just to have a bit of mathematics, but to be able to have a physical picture to go with it, right?
Maxwell famously.
There's a bunch of interesting examples of this, right? And it seems especially when you're breaking ground with a new kind of mathematical representation. So my other favorite example of this from quantum physics is spontaneous symmetry breaking. I think it's a very similar thing is happening here, we'll go into that example because it's too long to explain. So the other interesting part about this, though, is your intuitions can be about different types of systems that have different physical properties, and indeed even different causal structures, right? So I think Maxwell at least had the causal structure right, but you don't even have that in this case, right? So it's even more just a formal tool.
So it seems to me that there's two parts to both Butterfield and you. One is there's a mathematical duality that you are doing. It's mathematically simple. But there's a physical interpretation that is different.
Right.
So the question really is duality really a mathematical concept? And then comes the problem of the interpretation. That, it seems to me, is the two steps that you're talking about.
Right, and so this is why I thought, I think of my examples like this that I'm talking about as being examples of formal analogies, which are not examples of dualities.
But they're mathematically.
But right.
You're mapping one into the other.
Right.
And you're saying that whatever I do here will be reflected in a different way. So I take a correlation length, and here I'm getting a lambda going to infinity, the cutoff.
Right.
So you're equating those two together, and they're formally equivalent.
Right. So
mathematically.
Right. So the question is, what can we learn about physics merely from the fact that we have a formal equivalence?
Exactly.
So I think I'm on the same page, probably with Jeremy here, right? That just from the mere fact that there's a formal equivalence, that's not going to be enough to tell you about what's going on, right? There's a whole bunch of interpretive work that needs to be done.
Exactly, but if you don't have the mathematical duality, the interpretations are irrelevant. That means if you don't have the mathematical duality, then trying to interpret these duals is another problem. Which comes first, the mathematical duality, or then the interpretation?
I think that's one difference between these two types of cases, right? So, and maybe one of the questions I put up at the beginning, or one of the observations I made at the beginning is, it is in quantum theories that we tend to be finding cases like this, where these are the interesting questions, and where it can be the case this is even a bigger speculation, but I think it's because of the fact that we don't have the interpretation nailed down as determinately that we're finding these cases in which the formal can precede the physical interpretation.
Exactly.
Right? Which is then raising the question about what weight or what role the formal equivalences are playing in fixing physical interpretation. So my cases are easier than the duality of cases because I'm fixing the physical interpretation at the beginning and then looking at the consequences of the formal equivalences or formal similarities in these.
Thanks. Yeah, lovely talk. It's quite a bit I don't understand, but could I ask about the list from Wilson of about five points for the conditions of the applicability of the renormalization group? So this was about why were the formal amounts useful? My elementary understanding of this would pick out number four as the main one. Does he pick out number four?
It would be correct. Because that's exactly what the analogy that Wilson traced is basically conformal symmetry, which is something people knew from lambda phi 4, from which they, in fact, the renormalization group, the original Gell-Mann approach to the renormalization group came out. And when people realized or had a decent description of what the critical state of a ferromagnet or fluid was, it was characterized by these enormous range of fluctuations that basically covered the whole system. So this is a scaling, a highly scale invariant state, and that's what which led him to figure that he could compute the critical indices from the normalization group. There were approaches to it already beforehand from solid state people.
Right.
But the breakthrough was in fact this analogy, right, which is conformal symmetry on both sides.
Right.
Does he say the fourth is the most important?
Well,
my question: does he say the fourth is the most important?
Yes. I mean, so he contrasts, for example, with hydrodynamics. That's going to be when you really need to use renormalization group methods is when you have to take into account all these scales, right? A large number of scales. He does recognize that that's going to be the crucial one. The other ones are important to me too, but you're right that this is going to be the crucial one.
I mean, the other thing is that this relates to your previous thing about the, you know, one is a crystal process and the other is not. I mean, the point about number four is that it's really it's a comment about a state. A state has a property that it's got scale invariant correlations. A great deal of the rest is about the underlying dynamics, like the fifth one. The statement about overall intellectual understanding of the set of phenomena. And when you said earlier that lambda to infinity is not a physical process, but chi goes to infinity is, the way I understood that was not so, you know, you can worry, hey, edge effects, no magnet is really infinite.
Right.
And who knows about, you know, truly arbitrarily high real number values of energy or momentum.
Right.
So, but you're not making that point. It seems to me you're making the point that actually we tune to find this particular state where chi gets comparable to the size of the sample.
Right.
It's finite, actually, in real life.
Right.
But the point is, this is a special state. It's a physical process. Your language, it's a physical process. Rendering of that in English as it is a state-specific feature.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Whereas big lambda goes to infinity is nothing about the state-specific feature.
Right.
It's part of our intellectual technology for exploring different regimes,
right,
energy regimes.
Yeah. And so then,
is number four is a state-specific thing. And much of the other five are theory features, not state features. They're not features of a state. Sure,
right.
Fields fluctuate in all states, that's a feature of the theory.
Right.
So
Right, I see what you're saying, yes.
Am I totally...
Yeah, no, and you're right that that was especially, so you've been talking on the condensed matter side, right? And that, so that's especially important in understanding the condensed matter side, and then part of the story is understanding that on the condensed matter side then means once you see the formal analogy, you can use that to solve the other problem in quantum field theory.
Do you have your hand up?
I have a simple question about the formal side of the matter. So you emphasized the formal analogies and the physical disanalogies. Could you say a bit more about what formal disanalogies there are? I was thinking, for example, if I do a weak rotation of the Clang-Gordon equation, then I get, this, even though the equations get mapped one into the other, the set of solutions is very different because one will have zero modes and the other will not have a zero mode solution.
So back to the Wick rotation here. So I think it's important that all you're doing is you're mapping the expectation values, right? So you want to think more fundamentally in terms of what happens to the solutions. You're not taking the mapping that far in this for this application, right? All you're interested in at the end of the day is in getting out your propagators for your QFT, right? So,
For example, relation two, does it hold for like a subset of operators or a subset of states, as Jeremy said, but what is the kind of the range for which you can have this relationship?
It's a critical point. It's at the critical point that the correlation length goes to infinity in the Isaac model.
So this is before you do that.
And here's when the lattice goes to zero. In the quantum field, when the lattice, you have a lattice. You start off with a lattice. You do quantum field theory on the vertices.
Right.
And then you let the scale go to zero, the length.
Right. Yeah, but that hasn't happened yet, though.
But the point really is what you're dealing here with is the same thing as goes into the Ising model. That scale loss is at the critical point.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to understand is...
It doesn't occur in the high temperature.
All right. I think the better answer to your question, though, is that, of course, analytically continuing in this way from quantum field theory to classical statistical mechanics is a much bigger question, right? So I just took what Wilson took away. I just explained what Wilson took away from this. But if you're interested in thinking about how the states map and about what like your Hilbert space structure, right, and what happens, so that's what you're interested in.
The operators.
Right. So then naturally that's what happens on the mathematical physics side, right, in the mathematical physics tradition where you're trying to construct models of Hilbert space models, right. So that's not part of this project. So you don't have well defined Hilbert space structure or any of that. In this approach.
Okay. So you only have this analogy for this single equation? Or are there more?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So you're not worried about mapping fields to fields or, operators to...
Any last questions? All right, well, thank you all of you for coming as well, and we look forward to welcoming you.